Well, good morning again. This is Eric Ellefson. Thank you for joining me for Conversations with Educators. Today I'm with Chuck Evans, who is a former head of school in Virginia and Texas. He's served schools as a teacher, leader, and consultant for more than 25 years, has worked as a lobbyist in the Texas State Legislature, a certified mediator, is a founding board member of CESA, and currently runs his own company called Better Schools. Chuck, thanks for being with me today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. Happy to be here.
So Chuck, you know, some of the questions I've been thinking about, I got three main questions, and I know they, you know, they can kind of lead to all kinds of different places, but the first one in particular is in regards to your newsletter that I believe you sent out last week, where you highlight that there's been a slight growth in the private school sector. And that you suggest in that newsletter that the downturn really allowed for, and maybe was even a good thing, that it allowed for school leaders, schools itself, to recalibrate their expectations, recalibrate their distinctive, kind of define a little bit more who they are and who they'll be in the future. You know, can you give me some feedback on what you've seen over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years even, and then where you've seen this recalibration happen and how it's happening, but then also, like, why is it good that even in good times that you should consistently be recalibrating who you are as a school?
So I think in the last five to 10 years, if you go all the way back to the recession, you know, the cataclysm, 2007, 2008, there was a feeling within private schools and especially Christian schools that in some ways schools are sort of immune to the larger economy, the macro economy. When I first got involved with Christian school leadership 20 years ago, I mean, to be honest, you looked around and it just looked easy. Schools were growing, schools were starting up. I mean, it was almost as if, you know, you start up a Christian school and people just flock to it. And I think that we were sort of inoculated against the idea that that we were affected by outside forces, external forces, that we existed within this bubble of Christian people, people of goodwill who wanted great things for their kids, and they were just looking for us. They were looking for schools where their values would be compatible, where the kids would get a decent education, if not a great education, and they would get to, you know, be on teams and participate in other co-curricular activities. And so I think what happened is when the recession hit, and in around 2009, 2010, we started to see that Christian schools were heavily impacted by the external economic forces. And it required or it led to quite a bit of soul searching. It also, you know, led to quite a bit of trauma. I did some research and written about this other places, but just within you know, some large Christian organizations, as many in a very short period of time, a 5-year period, as much as 20%, a fifth of member schools closed or were consolidated. Catholic schools over that similar period of time between 2000 to about 2012-13 lost a quarter of their schools in the U.S. So there, that realization that we don't exist in a bubble, I think, really hit us hard, and it led to some real soul searching, and that soul searching, the most productive that I have been a part of or that I've observed, has led to or has required that we come to terms with some realities that previously we didn't either acknowledge or we were holding on to myths that were the opposite of reality. So that's the big picture. I think that is in the most productive situations, both within individual schools and associations. That is what's been going on.
So kind of the second question to that big kind of picture and those big changes is when you travel, when you work with schools in your interim roles, what are the qualities of the schools? You know, are there a couple qualities that you see that schools who've made the adjustment or schools that are kind of merging into a stronger place or a thriving place, are there qualities that you're seeing in common amongst the schools that are doing well right now?
Yes, and I think it starts with a leadership structure, both the volunteer governance as well as executive leadership in the school, being willing to challenge the assumptions that they've been operating from for as long as the schools have been in existence. Asking ourselves questions like, you know, if the conventional wisdom among private schools is that there's a correlation, sort of an inverse correlation between tuition and enrollment, is that really true for us? Is it really true in our circumstances? The idea being that, you know, the higher your tuition, the lower your enrollment is going to be, or vice, that the pathway to higher enrollment is lower tuition and affordability. That's the kind of conventional wisdom that exists in our environment, so the successful schools that we encounter are opening themselves up to either being challenged or themselves challenging some of those basic working assumptions. Another thing that they are doing is that they're understanding themselves to be integrated into a larger economy. And I don't mean to reduce the success of schools just to finances and to economic circumstances, but has an awful lot to do with it, right? And so a more full realization that we operate in a marketplace, and we're offering the services for a fee, and as missionally oriented as we are and aspirational as we are in terms of the impact on culture and the lives of students and even eternity, those more mundane circumstances really affect us, and we need to understand how they affect us. And so working on that. And then I think also schools are tuning in more carefully to the expectations that parents and families bring into their relationships with the school. It used to be, I say this quite a bit, it used to be that partnership between families and schools was the school setting out its policies and the parents agreeing to abide by those policies. That was the partnership. It was a very one-sided relationship. We're the school, you're the family, you do what we say, everything's going to be fine. And these younger generations of parents are bringing whole different expectations into these relationships that are actually very reflective of the relationships they have in other aspects of their consuming lives. And so schools are actually, you know, successful schools that are successfully recalibrating are having to redefine what it means to be in partnership with families, and more actively taking into consideration what parents what justifies in parents' minds these investments that they're making for their kids.
So let me ask a follow-up question to that in particular, because it is amazing to see that change, especially I think especially in certain parts of the United States, but overall is in general. What have you seen? Are there practical applications or practical suggestions that you would say, hey, here are things to think about as you rethink what partnership means?
Yeah. I think, and this is pretty universal. It doesn't really have anything to do with region or cultural orientation, but parents really expect a lot more transparency about the way that the school operates, the way the school makes decisions, especially decisions that affect them, whether they're programmatic, whether they are financial, whatever the nature of the decisions. They want to know how the sausage is getting made, right? And that's hard for schools, because we're actually very accustomed to running our schools in sort of a black box. Like I said, the nature of partnership traditionally has been, we're going to make decisions, we're going to establish policies, you're going to abide by those policies, and that's what partnership looks like. But it's just not sufficient anymore. And so whether it's what, you know, we're asking people to donate whether we're asking them to spend their time, whether we're asking them to whatever demand on their resources that we're expecting, they're expecting a transparent justification for that. And I think that for a lot of school leaders, that's been kind of terrifying and threatening, right? That all of a sudden the balance of power is shifting, and we've got these parents who are just trying to run the show, and not everybody's making that adjustment well, but many schools are, and they're finding that there is a better way to partner with parents. There are better ways to partner with parents.
No, this is great. So kind of like the third question I was thinking about, it maybe relates a little bit, and you tell me if it's too broad of a leap, is that I think we see in America that, you know, a lot of our schools, especially private schools, but then even other organizations have been set up on kind of a community-based, local-based, volunteer-based, and then we get boards that are created out of that. And so even our boards kind of generated from, you know, those local communities. But as our culture changes, as things changes, we see the shrinking of volunteerism in certain areas. Like, how are you seeing boards being constituted? How are you seeing some of this where it seems like boards are becoming more corporate and professionalized rather than volunteer? But yet, you know, and then how do you kind of bridge the gap between what was used to be kind of from the community to now, you know, this board that's over a school in this community, and then the gap between the transparency even there? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And that's not too broad a leap at all, because it goes right to motivation. What is it that motivates people to serve a mission, serve an institution like a school? And I think a couple of things have happened at the board level that I think are very positive. And I can characterize it by a board's perspective. So if you were to sit in the typical board meeting 10 years ago, as recently as 10 years ago, maybe even more recently than that, I don't know. Different schools, of course, are making these transitions at different speeds, but there would be a lot of backward looking conversation. So we're reviewing statistics, we're talking about things that happened in school, some of them, you know, at the governance, you know, appropriate governance level. Are we really sticking to our policies, or is our policy sufficient for this or that circumstance? Some of them not really rising to the level of a governance or a policy conversation. What happened on that team, or why weren't parents aware of some circumstance on campus or whatever? versus more forward-looking conversations. What are we going to do? Who do we want to become? How are we going to get there? Those types of more strategic strategic questions. So the combination of circumstance of sort of the precariousness of schools in the economy, the intersection or the introduction of these higher level of parent expectations for how much information they have and what kind of information they have about the school, how it operates, are forcing in a positive way a more strategic orientation for a lot of boards. Another just sort of practical, more, you know, very, very mechanical aspect of what boards are doing is that they're having to examine, and this goes to your comment about the reduction in volunteerism, however that's manifested. This people are just more protective of their time, right? For many positive reasons, they're busier, and so they're more protective. You know, they're busier with their work, with their commutes, and so they're more protective of time at home with their families, or service in their church, or whatever it is that is important to them. Schools, I think, are finding themselves having to be more respectful and more efficient in the use of people's time. So at a basic volunteer level, there are just fewer parents who can come up and spend day, hour after hour on campus assisting with this or that, largely because of the economy. And at the governance level, boards are, there just aren't that many people who can show up anymore, 12 times a year for 3 to 4 hour meetings. And at the end of that, say, I feel like that was a good use of my time. And so just at a very practical operational level, boards are having to rethink whether the ways in which they operate are attractive to the people that they need to serve, or whether they are an obstacle to people's willingness to serve.
So let me ask a last question then in regards to your experience, your leadership in developing boards and training boards and working with them, but then also in the executive leadership side of things. And it's maybe a little anecdotal on my side, because I have a number of friends who are, school leaders, and probably, and we know the data on school leadership and the longevity and the difficulty of having sustainability in those leadership positions.
Yeah.
But usually, like when I talk to many of my friends, is the board is the biggest barrier to long-term sustainability for school leaders. They wear them out. They feel like they're fighting against them all the time or consistently, or there's a conflict. What would be your advice, whether it's a board member who's listening to this or a school leader who's listening to this, with some of these changes and with the successful schools that you're working with or that you've seen, like what's the interaction between the board kind of doing what the board's supposed to do and leading and guiding and being strategic, but yet at the same time, the school leader now moving into much more of a leadership role of leading and guiding the board. How does a board look at this, and how does a leader look at this kind of dance where it can be successful for a school to have a long-term healthy leadership, situation?
Yeah. So I'll get at that from three perspectives. So one is structural, and this has to do with how boards organize themselves. I think that one of the reasons that boards and heads have unstable relationships is because the boards themselves are unstable. And an example would be, we have board members appointed to 3-year terms. Most schools allow, an extension, but we don't, because of the way that we operate, we don't make it really possible for people to comfortably serve for long periods of time. So either our policies force this turnover on the boards, or the pace of work and the requirements of showing up for meetings that don't accomplish anything, just meetings for meetings' sake. Those types of dynamics, I think, discourage or they create instability, so that the boards themselves don't really have the opportunity to develop a high level of competency that they can propagate over time. So I think that is one part of it. Some of the best boards that I've worked with over the last 10 years or so have people who've been serving on them for 10, 12 years. And whether they are just super sacrificial individuals, or whether the school has understood that structurally we need to make that a possibility for people by reducing the number of meetings, reducing the amount of administrative responsibility, whatever it is, some of those schools have a tendency to hang on to their heads much, much longer. So that's one way to get at it. From a board perspective, boards and heads together, I'll just kind of take these simultaneously. I think there needs to be a commitment or an understanding that this has got to be a partnership in leadership. Part of that has to do with just following basic organizational rules and people staying in their lanes. But it's not just that. I mean, I think it's more of a posture toward how can we best benefit the school with our leadership, and how do we build that partnership. On the board side, they need to be more stable, more informed, and more competent in their role, have a greater understanding of what good governance actually looks like. I think on the head of school side, we need to be, as a former head of school, we need to be more open to interactions with board members, less protective of our sovereignty, if you will, and just willing to have conversations, conduct dialogue mm-hmm. around things that we as professionals think we already know the answers to, but that as a collaborative team of leadership, everybody needs the opportunity to learn together and to think together. And so I think that what we're seeing in successful head board relationships today, and I've got, you know, a dozen or more schools where the heads have been successfully leading their schools for 10, 12, 15 years now. We're finding that these heads understand that they cannot run their schools by fiat and sort of keep board and board members in a closet somewhere to be brought out only when they need, you know, a policy changed or money raised or whatever else, that this is going to have to work in a dynamic sort of partnership. And it's not easy. Requires a lot of energy, a lot of time, but the successful schools, I think that's where they're mostly headed, and that's what they're trying to do.
Chuck, I really appreciate you sharing your expertise. Let me put you on the spot with one last thing as we kind of finish out 2017 and head into 2018. And, you know, because of your experience and background, you know, with what you've done and where you're going, like, what do you see maybe even in short term ahead, you know, for 2018? You know, what would be a prediction for 2018 that you would tell, you know, people that you're working with or advising or other schools, say, hey, you know what, here's an opportunity as we look at the short term here in this next year?
Well, I'm really optimistic about the prospects for independent schools. I think that we you know, we have to continually adjust our expectations to, you know, maybe having a smaller piece of the market share in education, in the educational landscape, but a more secure piece, because people are really looking for value, and they're looking for educational experiences for their kids that correspond to their personal values as individuals and families. And private schools are, you know, we're adaptable, we're agile, and we can figure out what families need from us much more quickly and respond much more quickly than public schools. And so that's, I think, a huge advantage. But if I were to predict, 2018, I would say, on a negative side, don't expect national private school choice. It ain't going to happen. So we're not going to be able, you know, and we wouldn't want to, use government funding as a crutch in the long term. But positively, I think that the economy is certainly helping with this, but I think there's a lot of confusion in the educational landscape, a lot of confusion among parents and parent consumers about what's best for their kids. And I think we've got a great opportunity to partner up with them and to really serve them well.
Thanks, Chuck. I really appreciate your thoughts, your wisdom, and look forward to catching up in 2018.
Thanks for having me. It's been awesome.